Good evening and welcome again to Extension 720. We are going directly to work tonight. The newscast will come in about 10 or 12 minutes. But I'm eager to get to it and to get to our special guest for the evening. Amity Schles is a very well-known journalist, general journalist, foreign affairs journalist, and in recent years, an economic journalist. She is the author of a new book titled The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Now, I remember the Great Depression. That's when we plunged into the economic maelstrom and ultimately into the economic wilderness directly after the stock market collapse. And one man sustained us during that difficult time and ultimately worked his magic with all sorts of new invented agencies and newly considered economic policies. And that man, namely Franklin Delano Roosevelt, before he engineered the great victory in World War II, engineered our recovery from an economic disaster. That is a general, one might say, the received view of the history of the New Deal. You don't quite share that, do you?
Journalist, you run into these edifices, these big buildings. You're kicking your toes against the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Wagner Act and so on. Eventually you say, what are these edifices? So I thought I'd go back and take a new look at the period. It was extremely different from the received wisdom, the story that you just told.
So you want to cure us of our edifice complex?
Exactly. Well, I wanted to cure myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you were once a fan of the New Deal. Also,
no, right? I think I was neutral, but I had learned a certain set of things, and I thought, if they're not really true, well, maybe we can begin again and learn something from whatever the real story was, if we can find it.
Well, are they not really true? You do a revisionist history. That is, you're saying that the received wisdom may be received, but it isn't all that wise. It doesn't really check out against the available facts once you look rather closely at the facts. What facts are discrepant with the mythic view that I've just summarized?
Well, I ended up starting with the 20s. I think we learned, if you look in the John Kenneth Galbraith or the other texts, that the 20s were somehow questionable, that they had this frivolous aspect, and that the growth of the period, that incredible stock market rise, was not real. That's what we learned. But when I went to look at the economics, and a lot of scholars have already looked into this and written it in a technical way. A lot of the growth of the 20s was real. It was very much like a decade we know now, the 90s.
For you, one of the best American
technology.
For you, one of the best American presidents is Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, so that was the first revision. Was Calvin turned out to be wonderful? He was the minimalist president. He withheld. He was sort of like someone trying to windsurf. It looks easy, but it. Great physical strength goes into it. He withheld himself. He did not intervene in a wonderful way. And there was a lot of innovation in the period, very much like the 90s. Electricity was the internet of the period. Every year it grew, no matter what. And it was just, they had bets on things like television, Radio Corp, which became RCA, bet on the future of television. And they were actually right. Television would turn out to be a profitable industry, and the innovation was important. But all the productivity gains weren't quite there yet for everyone to see. And when the market crashed, people came to believe that capitalism is broken. So that's the second thing that was wrong.
You, in essence, assert that if we had just left the economy alone, if we hadn't started intruding with all the Rooseveltian institutions that were invented, with all the rather turbulent economic policy that was now developed, if we had just done very little of that, there would not have been a depression. The great crash of 29 would now be considered merely a market correction, and we would have recovered much sooner from the economic plunge that we had taken, if only we had left the whole economy more or less to right itself.
Close to that. I believe that what was wrong with Hoover, and Hoover is really the first problem in this book.
You see him also as a tinkerer rather than as a do-nothing.
He was yes, and the second revision is that he was a tinkerer, not a do-nothing, hardly laissez-faire at all. Neither Hoover nor Roosevelt believed in the private sector enough, and that was especially strange in the case of Hoover, who was like a Bill Gates in his generation, the highest paid private sector man in his field when he was in his late 20s. But both of them didn't really trust the market or the economy. So I wouldn't say if they had left everything alone, but rather had they trusted the market more and recognized, especially Roosevelt, that the future of the country inhered in market growth, we probably would have been out mid-30s. There was a depression within the depression, late 30s, that was especially unnecessary. There was an aspect to the story which did need fixing or changing, and that was monetary. There was a monetary problem, but most of the characters we're talking about now did not understand it.
We're going to pause now and again during the proceedings tonight to listen to some of the voices of that time, certainly the voice of Roosevelt more than once. Here is Roosevelt in the famous first inaugural address, the address which contains lines that everyone will recognize. I needn't even repeat them at the moment. You'll know just what is the quote from this speech. But here he is talking about what we have to do from here on.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly speaking conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured. We will survive and we will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
There we have it. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Beautifully articulated. He had a great stagey quality. In fact, he was just made for radio, you say.
He was made for radio, and his message was strong, and it was one which reached the people.
Mm-hmm.
The radio part of him, when you come in a new medium, if we were doing it now, we would be blogging or the candidate would be on YouTube. He came with this new medium and he reached them. And the content of that speech is fine. What the problem was the policy that went with it. Because especially if you say to an economy, I will do, what goes with that is bold, persistent experimentation. You remember that phrase. I will do, we will pursue bold, persistent experimentation. One of the problems Roosevelt had was that causes uncertainty. So what does the market do? What if you turned on a CNBC today and said, we will do bold, persistent experimentation, what the market does is it freezes. We know that from our own experience. He was a very inconsistent president economically, and what we learned as children was that was all right because at least he did something. And what I discovered when I went back and looked is the people in the markets were waiting for him to stop doing something so that they could resume business.
He sometimes explained his general method by saying he was experimenting. Better to experiment than to just stand by.
Well, there's an economic theory that goes with that, and that's Keynesianism. And he mm-hmm. didn't even know Keynes very well. It came from Britain and came over, and Roosevelt was a little confused by him. But it said you can tinker till you get to something right. Keynesians think in aggregates and big down, and that's one reason my book is called The Forgotten Man, because it's about the little guy, what happens to him when the big tinkerer is tinkering so on and on. So this tinkering also hurt the economy, and what's so amazing was there were people who knew it at the time.
What do you make then of the fact that so many years later, another president of the United States, namely Richard Nixon, said, quote, we are all Keynesians now.
Well, Richard Nixon was a terrible economist, and he hurt the economy, he and Jimmy Carter.
Me too.
That's one reason conservatives don't like Richard Nixon. That's one reason he was so easy to let go of. He was a control freak, sort of like Hoover, with a worse personality. And he didn't understand. He was a lawyer, not a business mm-hmm. person. He didn't understand the economy, and he wanted to order it up and down. He had bad advice from the children, the students of Keynes, or the grand students, you know, going all the way down.
Well, now, who was the last American president who really, quote, understood the economy?
I think Reagan. understood Reagan. The economy. He understood that growth is where it happens. Mm-hmm. So he didn't do everything perfectly, but he understood growth is, that's what's our future. And one of the surprising things I found about Roosevelt is we think of him as optimist, happy warrior speaker. The one, and he was as a character, and there's nothing wrong with an executive being that. We need a president who's a leader. But his policy was severely pessimistic in the sense that he believed principally in redistributing a pie that wasn't going to grow.
What English observer was it who said of Roosevelt after meeting him, second-rate mind, first-rate temperament?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. But
do you think that's true?
I don't
his temperament sustained the country.
Well, every mind has its strengths. He was a great politician.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pretty good lawyer. He was a good Navy president. But he didn't really understand where the growth was or why it mattered. To him, someone wrote about Felix Frankfurt or Ray Moley, but it was also true of Roosevelt. He would sit at the table of life, and at that table would be maybe the union leader and the politician and the head of the business, and everybody else in the background were shadows, secondary people. So he didn't understand the markets, the people, the small businessman.
We are drawing from a wonderful new book that she has written titled The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. That's just now published by HarperCollins. And I have been informed, I'm sure reliably, that you're going to be at the top of the New York Times bestseller list this coming Sunday.
Not at the top, but on there.
One of the top 10, surely.
Not in the top 10, but in the extended bestseller.
Well, rising.
Rising.
A week later, it'll be still higher, and ultimately, you'll probably reach the very top position, and it won't take very long at all. This book is filled not only with economic analysis, but with a great deal of wonderful human material. To what degree does it reflect the true nature of that crisis?
The crisis was real, and one of the aspects of it that's hard to capture, but you see it very clearly when you go back, was deflation. There weren't enough dimes. The money ran out. In the book, I talk about how towns created their own money, scrip, because there was no real money to be had from Washington. So it was a literal deflation.
And because they lacked money, banks started closing.
These are the famous bank runs that were so important in the period. One of the characters in my book was Mormon, Mariner Eccles. And he had a few banks in Ogden, Utah, and so on, family banks. He was from a patriarchal big family, and he stopped the runs in that community by standing, just as we imagine, you know, right by the metal, beside the cage, telling the community, please don't take your money out, come another day. And he was so upset that at night he went to bed and dreamed about the economy. And later in the book, he follows along and becomes the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
How extensive was the poverty, really? Were people... You remember Roosevelt, in one of his famous speeches, says he sees a nation in which a third of the people are ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed.
The poverty was serious, and it was terrible. But you also remember that at the turn of the century, or in 1920 or 1930, even in good times, good share of the nation was ill-clothed and ill-fed relative to the successful urban people. You know, we had rural poverty all the time. We had a rural depression in the 20s when ag prices went down. So America was a less rich place in that time. And one of the things Roosevelt was saying is, let's improve our standard of living.
I'm suddenly remembering that General MacArthur, together with his adjutant, Lieutenant Colonel, if that's what he was, Dwight David Eisenhower, shows up on the streets of Washington to squelch and to push back a large group of veterans who've come to Washington demanding that they be paid, veterans of World War I, that is, demanding that they be paid a bonus that should recompense them for their service in the war and should help them out of the dire poverty in which they are suffering. They establish a sort of a camp of outcasts right there on the
Anacostia. They did. These were the famous bonus marchers. They came
bonus
with
marchers.
Hoover. They were there with Roosevelt, and there was no Social Security yet. So their bonus was supposed to come when they were older. It was sort of a version of a pension.
That does sort of suggest that this might have been rather equivalent to what things felt like in Paris just a day or two before the revolution.
But it wasn't like a revolution. That was the difference. There were always groups. There were always people who said revolution was coming. But when I went back and looked, the vast mass of people were not revolutionary. They were unhappy. They wanted a job. They had no job. But a lot of them turned inward and said, I will do this really through effort and sit it out, and things will become better. And they did become better. One of the characters in my book is Father Divine.
I found that fascinating. Tell the world who Father Divine was. Most of our younger listeners would never have heard his name.
Well, one of the great legacies of this period is how to find strength in yourself when things are bad and you can't do a thing about it. Father Divine was a cult leader. He lived in Harlem. He was black, but he didn't recognize color. When in court he was asked about black, white, Negro, colored, he said, no, just lighter complected or darker complected. He thought he was God.
He announced it
from time to time, and he preached his own version of the Gospel of Plenty. And one of the writers I was reading and he held banquets during the Great Depression when people were starving, and anyone who came could eat whatever he liked, and they multi-course things with hams and vegetables, and there was a vessel from which milk flowed and never stopped. And the milk kept flowing in this sort of magical way. And one of the observers, who was a writer, went behind the table to see why did the milk keep flowing. And he saw boys pumping very fast in some kind of contraption. Father Divine preached that growth would come and wealth would come if you worked hard enough. And he was a little bit of a creepy guy. He had all his followers, many of whom were women, went work as domestics, mostly all around New York, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them, really thousands, and then he would collect the money. But he had a doctrine which I thought was so American. He preached salvation through real estate. Real estate will save you and redeem you. He was very unhappy with Roosevelt because he noticed that Roosevelt didn't care much about the Constitution when it came to the National Recovery Administration or a bunch of other laws, but suddenly got quite prissy about federalism when it came to passing anti-lynching law. Roosevelt just couldn't get it together to push the Southerners to be for a law that would stop this murder that was happening in the South. You can say it was hard for FDR. He couldn't. But anyway, Father Divine was angry. And so he got at Roosevelt in a wonderful way. He decided to buy a house. Roosevelt was at Hyde Park on the Hudson, this nice house. Pretty nice among great mansions such as the Vanderbilts, this sort of upper middle class to rich family, but not.
This is up the Hudson.
Up the
Dutch
Hudson
territory.
Where the Dutch people live. And Father Divine said, okay, and he bought the estate just across the Hudson from Roosevelt. And he said, that is FDR, I am FD. And the cartoonists of the time made cartoons, FD versus FDR. And so he had his own way of getting in Roosevelt's face. And it was quite controversial. This was a time when there were no black people living in big estates along the Hudson, and yet he was sending Roosevelt.
It was really a great commune that he ran.
He ran a commune, and he was sending. And then when Roosevelt wouldn't listen, he decided he'd go one closer and buy the Vanderbilt estate, which is just north of Hyde Park, where Roosevelt lives, just north. And Mrs. Roosevelt wrote him a letter. He wrote Roosevelt a letter saying, "You're buying this property, yours, Father Divine. And I won't do it if you object," or something like that. And Mrs. Roosevelt wrote back, well, any citizen in America can buy property anywhere, but the Vanderbilt estate has some rare arboreal specimens, special trees, and we feel perhaps, I'm paraphrasing, that it ought to go into the public sector, maybe be a park or something, and not suited for purchase by anyone.
Even God.
And it did, Father Divine did not get the Vanderbilt estate.
Have you ever looked into the theology of the Father Divine movement? How did he account for the fact that he was God? There has to be a narrative, a divine narrative about Father Divine.
It just came over him. There was a he kind of did civil disobedience in a medium-sized way. He was constantly getting into trouble with state law. That was his way of protesting the bigotry of the states in the South.
Well, there's that wonderful incident where he is sent to jail for something, whether it had to do with a violation.
Disturbing the peace. His people sang very loudly in all-white suburbs, and that there would be
and
big
so
tension
he is,
over that.
He is in jail someplace,
in jail.
And the judge who has just sent him there, 2 days later, dies. He's an older man, and he has a heart attack, I suppose, and he drops dead. And when the reporters come to jail to tell this to Father Divine, his famous answer is, I hated to do it.
Yes. And he had a wonderful way with language. He made up words.
Yes.
When he didn't know the word, he made it up. He was a poor man. He was not so educated. He was that kind of preacher. And he was an expert in African-American history, could place him. But he was over more in the Booker T. Washington and away from the Marcus Garvey, if you wanted to place him. But he did have an optimism, and he was doing that in contradistinction to the New Deal. Mm. The New Deal disturbed him because he feared that blacks would become accustomed to receiving money from government, and he wrote to Harold Ickes about it.
Now, another talismanic figure of whom you make a great deal is the man who founded Alcoholics Anonymous.
Oh, yes. I really came to like him a lot. There, Bill Wilson was a small-time stock analyst. He was kind of an innovator. He was interested in Thomas Edison. He went out to Thomas Edison's place in New Jersey to take a test, to maybe go work for Edison. He decided, you know, in those days people did speculate about companies while knowing less about them. He thought there's got to be a science for this, and he began to develop it in a very small way with family, friends, money. But he really was an alcoholic, and at night he lay around the cobblestone streets of Brooklyn Heights or New York. But then the country went in depression, and he lost his money with a lot of other people, and he went on a lot of binges and trouble with his wife. Eventually, he had an innovation, not a markets innovation, but an American innovation. He said, let's get together and talk about our problem, the problem in this instance being alcoholism, mm-hmm. as a group, as a community, form a community, and do this in the absence of a clergyman or expert, which is different from the tradition. In the tradition, you go to the minister, or nowadays you go to the psychiatrist or the therapist or the social worker. He said, we can solve this among ourselves. And by talking through this problem and helping one another, the self-help group, we will transcend it. That was AA. And he wrote the big book in this period. And he said, this is the answer. And I think it's so important because today all of us have some self-help group or other. I have a self-help group for my bunion. I go and read online what all other bunion people have to say about their metatarsal, you know, and what's going on with their feet today. You don't have to be an alcoholic, you know, but this idea that Americans through self-help can transcend something is so much more important. And I noticed AA was his thing. There's a New Deal institution called AAA, Agriculture mm-hmm. Administration Act.
Whose first administrator, I believe, right. was Henry Wallace.
It was Henry Wallace. Right? And I just think AA is so much more important than AAA to us today. That's the legacy I was trying to recall.
Bill M. Wundt, the famous father of experimental psychology, when a particular, when James McKean Cattell came to do his doctorate with him, Cattell being his first American student there in Leipzig, in the 1870s, and James McKean Cattell conceived as a, this is coming to something, you may wonder what in the world I'm dragging in here, but it's coming to something quite relevant. Cattell offered as the topic for his dissertation, he wanted to do measurement of individual differences in reaction time. And Wundt said, why? I don't get the point. Well, that doesn't test any important idea. He said, yes, but it's so interesting to see how people differ from one another. And we have this new instrumentation. We can give them stimuli and see how quickly they respond, and it's all automatically recorded. And individual differences are so fascinating, Dr. Herr Professor Doktor. To which Wundt finally replies, ah, jetzt sehe ich, das ist ganz amerikanisch. Now I see, that is very American. And you're saying that these self-help movements and the Father Divine movement somehow bespeak an American quality of character and of social ambition.
Well, yes, there's this legacy from the period too, and I just it's very close to who we are now. And when we look back, what do you do when you have a disaster? The Great Depression was like Katrina all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Katrina nonstop. Do you suspend disbelief, or do you look in, or do you do both? And what is the right thing? I found all these characters who had been sort of obscured by the traditional history, the forgotten men, who were so interesting and important.
But is it ganz amerikanisch? Would they have reacted differently if they had had the same economic disaster in Europe?
In Europe, they would have gone much harder left, and they did. Or they would have gone much harder right, and they did. Hyperinflation.
They would go to political extremity.
National socialism. Italian fascism. Mm-hmm. There was a writer called Odette Coyne, K-E-U-N, who came from Europe. She was fairly left-wing. She was quite a good writer, sort of a feature writer. And she came after the Wagner Act to visit the Tennessee Valley mm-hmm. Authority to touch the heart of American labor and write about it. And she said, I made this flabbergasting discovery. American labor is conservative. It's in their temper, their temperament, they are not about to do social revolution. And one of the points I try to make in the book, because I discovered it, is this idea that it could happen here, that there was going to be revolution here, if not but for Roosevelt, was a bit overdrawn, maybe exaggerated.
Yes, that is one of the common versions of that period of history, that Roosevelt saved the country from either fascism or communism, and he saved capitalism by controlling it.
He saved capitalism by, that's the argument. And maybe capitalism didn't so much need to be controlled in this period. The interesting thing was he had a lot of advisors, and I traced them through this book. Mm-hmm. Oh, this book is really about policy agony, too. You go in government, you have an idea. I traced some of the more left-leaning ones, Rex Tugwell, for example, who was in Chicago for a while. And they go in government, they have the idea, it doesn't really work. They realize it doesn't work.
Well, let's talk about...
Roosevelt doesn't like them.
Let's talk about the Roosevelt Brain Trust. There, the group of people around him, Tugwell is one, Tommy Corcoran is another. You can name the others.
Yeah, early and late Brain Trust people.
What was the Brain Trust?
Well, Roosevelt drew on academics. He said, let's go to the academics.
Professors,
no
less.
Professors. He liked professors. Nothing wrong with that. In the book, in a lot of these...
There may be something.
A lot of the professors were rather left-leaning. In the book, many had not a lot of faith in capitalism. In the book, I distinguish between two kinds of person. The kind of person who is an exporter of America, and Hoover was that. He believed America more or less worked and you should export its ideas, and someone who is an importer in America who believed basically America needed ideas from abroad to succeed. And these were all importers. They were people who thought the foreign model was the interesting one. And in 1927, a bunch of professors went on a rather obscure trip to the Soviet Union. I chronicle this because they all wrote diaries, somewhat different accounts, but basically the same story. They went over on the President Roosevelt to see Stalin.
Named for Theodore Roosevelt.
The President Roosevelt was named after the first progressive president, and they went over to see, they were junior professors, maybe they weren't going to get tenure, they were too left-wing, they weren't very important in America. America had 1-3% unemployment, so their left-wing message didn't work.
Name them. Tugwell is one. Stuart Chase is another.
Yes, Tugwell is one. He was a professor of economics at Columbia.
Later on, he wound up at the University of Chicago.
He did. Another was a sort of popularizer, kind of a Paul Krugman of his day, but something also more interesting because he was had a whole movement, technocracy, named Stuart Chase. He also wrote later about words. He was interested in semantics. Yet a third person who was there at least part of the trip was Roger Baldwin, one of the founders of the ACLU. There were some union people, a fellow named Brophy, and so on. These small people, because the big union, the Will Green, the AFL, did not want to recognize the Soviet Union and deplored the Soviet Union. This is in the 20s and didn't want anything to do with it.
They go over there in 27 and they have 6 hours with Stalin.
They go, and imagine you're a not very important professor in a period where your theories look irrelevant. In the 28, you know how well the conservatives did. That was the Hoover victory. So they're feeling kind of sour and sad, and they go over and they get the red carpet, really the red carpet. Stalin says, what an opportunity. And first he sends them over to see Trotsky so they can get the feeling the place is sort of liberal. Trotsky is still there. He's wearing a nice suit. They get hours with Trotsky. He's so brilliant. Trotsky was the shining figure. And then they get 6 hours with Stalin himself. And he practically pours them tea from his own personal samovar. They're in the room with him. Some of them thought he was the servant at first. He looked so unassuming. They all wrote it down, and they just couldn't believe it. Some of them sketched pictures of him. It was amazing. And they said, is there religious freedom in Russia? Which is one of the questions that everyone had, really great concern about Russia, Soviet Union. And he kind of winked at that because church bells were ringing just around that time. And these people were transfixed, because whether or not you subscribe to Stalin, these were not traitors. They were New Republic authors. To get 6 hours of FaceTime with a global leader is
a great American quotation, not from somebody in the Brain Trust, but at the time an honored American journalist, sort of the dean of American left-wing journalists, namely Lincoln Steffens, goes to the Soviet Union, perhaps a few years before this occasion, and he comes back and says, I've been over into the future, and it works.
Right.
That was the way the left in America thought about the Soviet Union.
But I don't want to lay it all on the left. You look at, on the right, they were obsessed with Mussolini.
Yeah.
There was an incredible...
Who does make the trains run on time.
And there was an incredible obsession with the economy of scale. There was the concept that America was so inefficient with all these states, you know, everybody doing things differently, different standards. Hoover really didn't like. There were so many different standards. Got it. So they all wanted bigness, looking for size.
And they began to tinker in very interesting ways with the economy and with the total society. The alphabet soup of new agencies invented by Roosevelt and his brain trust and the great innovations they made were transformative in some ways, even though maybe they didn't work all that well. And ultimately, they came a cropper when the Supreme Court knocked down the crucial and central piece of all of these new programs, namely the National Recovery Administration, of which we've not yet said anything. When does he take office? March 1933?
Yes, in those days, presidents were inaugurated later, and
That's
it
right.
was problematic because you have this long period between November, Hoover loses, and Roosevelt comes in. There were a lot of trouble with the banks in that period, and Hoover begged Roosevelt to get together, but Roosevelt waited.
Now, let's listen to Roosevelt laying out some portion of his plan for the country. Here's a speech in October 23, 1933. He's only been in office then for whatever the number of months is from March to October. And he's updating the progress of his policies.
It is 3 months, my friends, since I have talked to the people of this country about our national problems. But during this period, many things have happened. And I'm glad to say that the major part of them have greatly helped the well-being of the average citizen. In the short space of these few months, I am convinced that at least 4 million have been given employment. Or saying it another way, 40% of those seeking work have found it. That does not mean, my friends, that I am satisfied or that you are satisfied that our work is ended. We have a long way to go. But we are on the way. We come to the relief, for a moment, of those who are in danger of losing their farms or their homes. I have publicly asked that the foreclosure on farms and chattels and homes be delayed until every mortgagor in the country has had full opportunity to take advantage of federal credit. And I make the further request that if there is any family in the United States about to lose its home or its farm, that family should telegraph at once, either to the Farm Credit Administration or the Home Loan Corporation in Washington, requesting their help. I do not hesitate to say that although the prices of many products of the farm have gone up, and although many farm families are better off than they were last year, I am not satisfied. It is definitely a part of our policy to increase the rise and to extend it to those products that have as yet felt no benefit. If we cannot do this one way, we will do it another. But do it, we will. When we have restored the price level, we shall seek to establish and maintain a dollar which will not change its purchasing and debt-paying power during the succeeding generation. I said that in my message to the American delegation in London last July, and I say it now once more. Our dollar is now altogether too much influenced by the internal policies of other nations. Therefore, the United States must take firmly in its own hands the control of the gold value of our dollar. And as a further effective means to that end, I am going to establish a government market for gold in the United States. Therefore, under the clearly defined authority of existing law, I am authorizing the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to buy or sell gold at prices to be determined from time to time, after consultation with the Secretary of the Treasury and the President. This is a policy and not a mere expedient. I have told you the story of our steady, mature work in building our common recovery. In my promises to you, both before and after March 4th, I made two things plain. First, that I pledged no miracles. And second, that I would do my best. I thank you for your faith. Our troubles will not be over tomorrow, but we are on our way, and we are headed in the right direction.
Well, isn't that fascinating? You're very interested in monetarist theory, and here we have the great shift in really the definition of the value and the nature of the American currency.
Well, this is all the Roosevelts, the wonderful Roosevelt. First, the one who understood about the homes, the one who understood about the trouble with the money. Here he's beginning to see, before he had thought it was inflation, he realizes now there needs to be more money.
Mm-hmm.
It's deflation. He's going to do something about it. That's the great part, along with the voice and the friendship. But what he did, by the way, the unemployment at that time was 2 in 10. So the progress was not coming as the way he's suggesting so dramatically. People were concerned. You look at the markets, they were concerned. The stock market was concerned. And it was because at the same time he was experimenting in hair-raising ways. Mm-hmm. He himself set the gold price, and he did it in bed after the egg and before the cigarette. And Henry Morgenthau, who would shortly become Treasury Secretary, and the others showed up, and he said, let's raise it by so-and-so. He was trying to figure out what to do, and he was experimenting. And he said, one day he said, let it go up by 21 cents. And Henry Morgenthau said, why 21 cents, Mr. President? And he said, because 7 times 3 is 21, and 3 is a lucky number. And Morgenthau wrote in his diary, which was later put together by the historian at Yale, John Morton Blum, if anyone knew how we set the gold price, I think he would be afraid. It was that arbitrary aspect to him. So the stock market, which is an important place for the U.S., you know, it's one of the ways we measure how we're doing, was scared out of its mind. Unemployment did not really go down. You know, if you look overall at the 30s, the unemployment was also 2 in 10, like there, you know the in the data in the late 30s. They never got back. They never got back to recovery. The Dow certainly didn't get back till the 50s. And they never got back in employment until World War II, when the military employed people, of course.
Let's come to the alphabet soup. What were some of the major agencies, just in terms of the letter acronyms that define them?
Well, the one that I'm so interested in the book, because it was central, was the NRA. We have our NRA about the rifles. They mm-hmm. had their NRA, National Recovery Administration.
Before we come to it, what about the CCC?
Civilian Conservation Corps. That was sort of nice. It was you go out and work if you're young. And there were, you know, the states were constantly tossing people around. If someone was homeless, they would throw him out of a town and send him to the next town. So the CCC created camps where people could go and work and build things, and roads and parks and things that we know today were built by the CCC. Starved Rock in Illinois is a product of
that wonderful lodge is built by the CCC.
New Deal. We have a bunch of those. We have TVA, the Tennessee Valley mm-hmm. Authority, which I write very much about in my book. And some of these I think are nice and inspiring and didn't hurt much. Others really crowd out the opportunity for
the NRA is the most dramatic and the most truly radical of all. What was it?
Well, it was a bunch of things that didn't go together and make sense. They said, well, let's try and improve the economy, sort of like they maybe are trying in Italy, syndicalists. So let's bring business to the table, big business, and let business self-govern by writing codes. And those codes will be in the name of efficiency. Again, a really romantic faith in bigness and efficiency, and everyone will be more efficient and the economy will come back. And if people charge too low prices, they'll cause deflation. So that kind of thing. They were the premises. Or if consumers have choice, that slows down the economy and it's preventing recovery. So let's not have consumer choice. Some of the NRA codes banned consumer choice. They were crazy things. The idea that consumer choice prevents recovery.
They were setting up
corporate
cartels. In essence,
that's right.
In separate one for each major industry.
Right. So you would get together with your industry, and people noticed very quickly this advantaged the major players rather a lot, who ruled, and the little players had to sign on. And then if they sign on, what did they get in their window?
What was the role?
The blue eagle.
There was a symbol
of the National
that
Recovery
you put in your window. What was the role of labor unions in these new?
Well, this was the pre-Wagner Act.
Yeah.
When the NRA was overruled, which we'll talk about in a moment, I hope. There was a labor component to it, and so they recast it in the Wagner Act, which is the modern labor law that we still have.
How long was the NRA in operation?
Wonderful story. In the book, the Supreme Court struck it down.
I want to come to that in a moment, but how long did it actually operate?
So that would be 35.
So
33, it was gearing up in 33, 34, it's going on, getting bigger and bigger.
And what consequences did it create?
Well, I think the best way to talk about that is to read a poem by Ogden Nash,
who
wrote the best description of it, better than any I wrote. Mumbledy Pummeldy, my red cow, she's cooperating now. At first, she didn't understand that milk production must be planned, but now the government reports she's giving pints instead of quarts. The theory that if everything were organized, it would be more productive, but in reality, it was less productive because it was organized in some sort of silly, modern times kind of way, mechanized way.
And back in New York City, some brothers, the Schechter brothers, ran a little business selling chickens.
A kosher butcher house.
Yeah.
Wholesale. So they had this, and they were aggressed by the government, just as you know of Al Capone. The feds come in and set them up because they're going to get them. These were the Schechters. They were deemed a good target through which to prove the legitimacy and constitutionality.
They were violating syndicalist rules that had been set by whom exactly?
By professors. So they
professors.
By more or less. So they said, and big businessmen, cynical big businessmen. So they were violating all these rules, and there were criminal charges.
What sort of rules were they?
Oh, they were letting the consumers pick their chicken. That was a big one. It was known, in fact, as the sick chicken case. Consumer choice, bad, broke the rule. They were, charging too low prices. Bad. And they were tried on many, many counts, dozens and dozens, violating this NRA. And what I loved about them, and I went and looked at the court books and found how they testified, was these were very humble people, didn't speak English very well, had recently arrived in the United States, were probably for Roosevelt, by the way, Jewish. But they couldn't believe that some authority could come to their chicken place and tell them how to run the business. And one of their friends, everyone was interrogated. It was very wicked. There was a big bigotry component to the federal government's prosecution. And the prosecution kept saying to them, to the people testifying, you didn't go to college. You're not an economist. How could you understand that what I'm telling you is right? You're no economist. You're no economist. And finally, one of the little chicken men, not a Schechter, but a friend, pulled himself together and said, I may not be an economist, but I am an economizer. And I know I have to charge low prices to survive. I know what the market is. I know that another one said, I know that customers can go next door, get same chickens, maybe for a lower price. And they had these accents, and they fought, and they thought they were going to lose, and they won. So
they won before the Supreme Court.
They won before the Supreme Court, right. They went all the way to the Supreme Court. It's known as the sick chicken case. If you talk to lawyers, they're very much interested in the jurisprudence of it, delegation, commerce clause, very important with this case. But what came out when I studied it, to me, was the common sense of these little Schechters. And also there was a religious component. They knew what authority was. They were kosher. They had an authority, the higher authority. That was the authority to which they reported. These little intruding policemen who came from the federal government didn't seem so important to them, and so they resisted.
That Supreme Court decision, in essence, knocks out the NRA and calls into question the constitutionality of most of the New Deal program.
Much of the New Deal, well, certainly the NRA, and in America they couldn't even grasp it. It was such a big story, but the British papers understood. They said, Roosevelt shocked, or I'm paraphrasing, New Deal killed in a few minutes, because the justices found that it was unconstitutional, goodbye, and one of them went into the cloakroom and said to Corcoran, or one of the other hot dogs, one of the young brain trusters who had come from Harvard, you go home and you go back to the president, you tell him this business of centralization is over. That's enough now. That was Brandeis.
The court packing plan that Roosevelt put forward as a way of handling this bunch of nine old men, as he called them, who were wrecking the New Deal.
We thought change the rules, retire some out, why not? And he had just won this tremendous victory, 46 out of 48 states.
Mm-hmm. The election of 36.
Feeling very strong. What a record. And he went to Congress about it, and he had a loyal man in the Senate, Robinson. And you remember, this is the day before angiograms, before air conditioning, more or less. So to be a senator in the summer when it's hot in Washington, arguing and arguing, and Robinson was doing this for him, and Roosevelt began to lose because the justices fought back. They wrote letters. They said, we can do our work.
Well, the plan was not only to push some of them into early retirement, but also to appoint extra members of the court.
Right.
For every court member over 70, if he persisted and kept his seat on the Supreme Court, you would have another extra justice appointed by the president.
And you'd water it all down. You'd water it all down.
Tremendous violation of the Constitution.
And he didn't really care, and he was angry, and he had bided his time until he was angry from 35, but he could only get this revenge, he thought, in 37. And it was his worst moment in terms of domestic policy, and people saw it, and and it died. And one of the sad things was that Joe Robinson died, had a heart attack of trying to pursue this, and Roosevelt was very upset. He loved Robinson. This was senators were often sick or ill or dying because before we knew so much about cardiology. So it was a great defeat for him, and the papers wrote that the court packing plan was dead as a salt mackerel in the moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
There was a moment of national revulsion over this effort. He had overreached 36, 37.
And does the New Deal mentality begin to dwindle from that point on?
Yeah, this is where what our memory is lacking, is this period. The New Deal mentality recedes. Roosevelt starts to turn abroad. But suddenly, partly because of their poor policies, depression again, down, down, down. They were still down, but depression within the depression. In the book, I noticed that it was when Andrew Mellon died. Sometimes markets react. Mellon was the guiding star. Mellon, even out of power, and he was being prosecuted throughout the 30s. We didn't talk about that. There are a lot of prosecutions in the 30s of capitalist figures, and Mellon was one of them. He was being prosecuted. Eventually, he died, summer of 37, and shortly after Mellon dies, crash, deeper, 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 and you have, again, 2 in 10 unemployment. These data, by the way, are from Richard Vedder, who worked on the basis provided by Liebergott, who's an important labor economist, because I know some callers may ask about that. So crash within the crash, great uncertainty, and there was an economist at the Chase Bank named Benjamin Anderson who understood all this and wrote it every week. What did Roosevelt do when the market crashed? He said, I'm going to attack business, and he turned against them again and created something called an undistributed profits tax to get revenge on business for not giving out its money. He's going to get at their essence, undistributed profits tax.
Your basic point in the book, I'm attempting to summarize, or attempting a kind of a reviewer's précis. Your basic point is that if only they had understood the operation of free markets and had respected that as the basic economic dynamic which builds wealth for a country, the New Deal would, you didn't need a New Deal. What you needed was a return to the wisdom of the market, left essentially uncontrolled except for SEC and a few other necessary intrusions. And that would have served the country much better than all this quasi-socialistic tinkering.
Yes, if only they had remembered what they had formerly known, which is that most of the future of this country is about growth. It's not about these structures. There were certain things they should and change and did, such as the SEC, even deposit insurance, which many conservatives abhor, I think is great. That's where I came out of specific rule of law things that made America a transparent, clear place to invest. If they had understood that there was a lot of growth, because at the core of their deflation problem was their mistrust of the market. They thought it was inflation because they didn't believe the growth could be real. So trust a little bit more in the American economy, which had brought it that far, and you would have seen a much shorter period. The story is not did World War II end the Depression, but why did the Depression last all the way to World War II?
And with that, we will go directly to the phones, and here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. I think not only sounds like an interesting book, but a service to history, because I think I understand where the author's coming from in terms of received wisdom. I'm not one of the older callers you requested, Milt, but I was born about 20 years, almost to the day that Roosevelt died, and so everything that I've learned about him, I've learned from my history books as opposed to observation, and I have wondered myself about a lot of this received wisdom. I've also wondered about the received wisdom of regarding Eleanor Roosevelt, who, wonderful discussion, but I'm surprised we haven't heard more about her, and I guess my simple question is, she doesn't seem to have a great deal of critics among historians, and yet the more I've read about her, not only was she obviously an immensely influential figure, it seems, but also potentially a very controversial figure had the media at the time been a little bit more sophisticated, and I'm wondering to what extent the author would like to straighten out the received wisdom regarding Eleanor Roosevelt.
If there is an icon greater than FDR, it is Eleanor. Eleanor is the greatest, and I found her a fascinating figure. Eleanor really was sort of semi-utopian. She worked very much with the economist I spoke of before, Rex Tugwell. They built little utopian communities, the Green Belts. There's one in Maryland now. She didn't believe in markets at all, speaking of markets, and she was very influenced by the left over there. She had her own school on the east side. She had her own little sort of trade factory at where they made furniture at Valkill, and she pushed Roosevelt to the left. I like one thing about Eleanor, though, which is her outreach to blacks, and I think that's important. In the Father Divine story, she was the one who was trying to help the blacks and talk about civil rights. She was a star on that.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Nice to have heard from you. We go quickly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi, how are you?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
I have a question. How would you offer compare the budget of the 1930s to the present, and what have we learned to prevent future long-term shocks?
Oh, I love this question. The budget of the 1930s was smaller than the state and local governments until 36, until this key election where Roosevelt establishes all these connections with interest groups and spends money. You know, the federal spending went from 3% of GDP or something like that to 9%, and 6 to 9 in a very short period during the Depression, and that must have felt like heroin to a country that had only tea, you know, all of a sudden billions and billions of dollars. So the idea that you spend and spend to get prosperity is still with us, but the part that's especially problematic to me is not the short-term deficits, but rather the entitlement commitments. Because if you owe all these groups, eventually you cannot pay for it. Reagan had this idea that you could outgrow entitlements. If the U.S. economy grew fast enough, the entitlements didn't matter. We're now at a stage with the entitlements, especially Medicare Part D, these Roosevelt legacy entitlements, that they will slow our growth and our future. So I think that period was very important.
Do I have this correct? Let me thank the caller first. Is this an apocryphal story? I think I've read someplace that Harry Hopkins, who was a very close confidant and sort of a general assistant to Roosevelt on all sorts of things, was asked once what the nature of the Roosevelt success was, and his answer was, it's very simple, tax, 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 spend, 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 elect, elect, elect,
elect, elect. I didn't verify it all the way, but that's what's attributed to that crowd, especially Hopkins. The one I kind of liked was the Chicagoan Ickes, because he got involved in the monetary conversations. He's like, oh, I'm in a meeting where they're talking about a topic about which I know too little. I will be silent. He was awed by the job he was getting. And when he got the billions, and it was billions, and then billion was a new word. They didn't say billion all the time, the way that, you know, in Washington, the way a billion mm-hmm. here, billion there, the way they do now. He said, oh, my goodness, we have so much money that we could take it and go across the nation and pour a billion out at every, pour a certain amount at every milestone, and we get to the West Coast, and we'd still have enough money left over to build a battleship. He realized the enormity of the money given to him and the task he had with the Public Works Administration, that it was so unusual, all this spending.
By email, somebody who identifies himself as a former lab school classmate of yours. You, of course, were raised in Hyde Park and went to the lab school. You know his name, but I'm not giving it on the air. But he offers this question. How did growing up on the South Side in the shadow of the University of Chicago inform or influence your thinking?
Well, there are two South Sides, aren't there? there's this the great liberal tradition of Southside, which is itself of two. There's liberalism in the classical sense, which is I am the individual, leave me alone. And Paul Douglas had that in him, the senator who was of Hyde Park.
Who was professor of economics at the university.
Professor of economics, and actually on my Soviet trip. In the book. He's in the book. Mm-hmm. And so he has a big political turning in the book in 1936-37. So there are various versions of liberal, but then there's also free market Hyde Park. There's the Hyde Park of Milton Friedman. So I think we were all swimming in both Hyde Parks, and the one that turned out to seem more compelling to me was the Milton Friedman Hyde Park, but the other Hyde Park is also interesting. You know, Illinois people are great reformers, left and right. And they were an important part of the Roosevelt administration and also in criticizing it.
Here, then, the next call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you. I want to say that I certainly plan to go out and get that book tomorrow. I have a couple of birthday presents to give people who are students, and I think that's going to be my answer to them, is to give that book. It sounds like it's a great read. My father and my wife's father were out of work during the Depression period, but they never voted for Roosevelt. They felt that they could see through the hypocrisy of the New Deal. For example, I call a question, perhaps she'd like to answer this, that when Hoover asked Roosevelt to help get the banks closed early so that people wouldn't lose their money, Roosevelt got the message, I believe, at the Stork Club up in New York. Hoover sent a Secret Service agent down pleading with him while he was president, would he please help him get the Democrats in Congress to go along with the bank moratorium. And Roosevelt simply smiled and said, we'll chop Mr. Hoover down to size and we'll wait until I'm president, which does not indicate to me that he was very worried about the common man. And I think basically the New Deal period brought on the new frontier, it brought on the Fair Deal, it brought on the Great Society and all these ills that we had by leaning on the government. I think we would have been much better off staying under President Hoover. We had had depressions before, we always got out of them, but direct individualism isn't such a bad idea when you think of what we've got now. A lot of people looking for support from government agencies, which is killing ingenuity, individualism, and perhaps our moral temper. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for buying it. There are two things I'd comment on there. The first is, since these first books that we read in school were written, we've had these decades of growth, the 80s and the 90s and now, and a lot of that growth has to be real. And so we've changed our view a bit about how the world works, and then we see more clearly how ridiculous some of those past things were. The second point, the caller is correct. Hoover really wanted to reach Roosevelt. He wanted so badly that he wrote him notes, and he was so upset, Hoover, that he misspelled Roosevelt's name. He wasn't a very good speller, Hoover, but he really said, let's get together. And there was a certain consensus among people who understood finance at that time, Wall Streeters, the Fed was saying that they knew how to fix it. You sort out the banks, you save some, you extend credit, and so on. So it wasn't as if Roosevelt invented this. And Hoover knew that if they got together, they could save a lot of banks and give a show of unity at a time of collapse. And Roosevelt chose to ignore him. Not only do I write about this, but also John Alter writes about it in his book, The Defining Moment, which is a book that comes at it, the whole story, a bit more from the left. And there's another book called The Interregnum, about this terrible period when Roosevelt, for political effect, holds off and says, wait till it's my watch so it looks the worst. I'm not quoting him, I'm paraphrasing. And then my rescue will have maximum effect. There was a cynicism there that was hurtful.
So therefore, how can the American historians possibly consider him to be a great man when he was so definitely flawed? They talk about Nixon being flawed. I'd say that kind of hypocrisy, that kind of demagoguery is far more poisonous than anything Richard Nixon did or some of the other presidents that liberal historians like to damn, such as Herbert Hoover himself, whom they consider to be unfeeling. Here was a man that came from very poor background. He lived in a house that isn't any larger than my study, and he was a self-made man and was a champion of rugged individualism. Here's Roosevelt, supposedly the champion of the people, but not worry too much about whose bank accounts are going to go down the drain before he becomes the new first man.
Roosevelt had the arrogance of wealth and have never really worked too much in the private sector. Hoover was extremely compelling. He was the highest paid young man of his generation. Luck makes talent look like genius. And when you are in a field, as Hoover was, he happened to have the cleverness, and it was admirable to go into the field of mining at a time of gold standard when the global economy needed to grow, and to do that it needed more gold, and he knew how to get the gold out of the ground. He was this wonderful engineer, and he went around the world rationalizing mines, figuring out how to make them productive. So he was the highest paid young man, as I say, of his generation, and it was in the papers, and the sun shone on him, and he went into the presidency and didn't understand why it didn't all work out and why he wasn't loved. So his personality wasn't so great for compromise.
But. Sir, we thank you for the call.
He never took the salary either, did he?
Right.
He didn't need it. We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. Quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Rosenberg?
Yes, sir.
How are you, sir?
Good.
I'm calling from Gary, Indiana. I'm a minister. And you mentioned, you and the lady mentioned about the CCC camp.
Yes, sir.
And I spent 2 years in there. I'm a Depression child, too. I lived through the Great Depression. Now, the CCC camp, I spent 2 years in there, and very similar to the U.S. Army, you know, in some ways it was.
What work did they have you doing in the CCC?
We planted locust trees. We built fence roads, and we did flooding. You know, like in ditches and things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in the barracks, same as soldiers. We had leaders and assistant leaders, the same as the buck sergeants and corporals, and we had a foreman instead of a lieutenant, you know, platoon leader. And they paid the soldier $21 a month then. Well, they paid us $30 a month.
Uh-huh.
They figured everything together, you know, with all the attention that they gave a CCC fella, it amounted to $3 a day.
So it was a good experience for you, was it?
A very good experience. That's where I met my wife. We were married going on 55 years before she passed.
Well, that's wonderful.
So we met her. I mean, I was in CCC camp at the time. We had a wonderful time, though. It was rough, but it was good. We had a great experience, you know, from that.
Well, sir, thank you very much for telling us about
that. Yes, sir, thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. And let me once again make perfectly clear in the Nixonian accent that the title of the book that we've been drawing from, but to which we have not been able to do full justice, there's so much rich narrative and fascinating detail, and we've essentially talked about the economic angle, which is very well developed in the book as well, of course. But the title of the book, The Forgotten Man, and the subtitle, A New History of the Great Depression, Amity Schles, that is spelled, by the way, S-H-L-A-E-S. It's important to get that clear if you want to order the book instantly. The Forgotten Man is just published by HarperCollins. And we go back to the phones to the next caller. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I wonder if your guest could comment about Dr. Townsend, I believe it was, the one who wanted the old age pensions. In addition, the other two figures from the left, Huey Long and Father Coughlin.
Three of the more eccentric and interesting public figures of that time.
What did you come across in your research about them?
When we cover this period and we go back and look, there are these three figures. Father Coughlin, radio preacher.
Anti-Semite.
Roosevelt's competitor as radio voice across the country. In the South, Huey Long, who had his Share the Wealth plan, and Dr. Townsend, who also wanted to share the wealth in creating a pension plan. You give in and then you get out. And there was, a hokey element, I hope I'm not wrong here, to the Townsend plan, whereby if you transacted a lot, they were obsessed with velocity. Basically, the economy would come back faster. Roosevelt, with Social Security, he was giving his own answer to the Townsend plan. And all these fellows were important. And it's generally argued that Roosevelt had to move to the left, otherwise they would have taken over. I don't see that happening. I really don't. And Huey Long, by the way, died before the end of 1935. So he wasn't a great threat in the election year that he's often depicted as.
Assassinated in the state capital of Louisiana.
Yeah, and Roosevelt was aware of these people. They were a concern to him. He had to tack left and right to cover them, but maybe they were less important than the standard history offers.
Well, Coughlin was a particularly unpalatable figure, a Catholic priest in the suburbs of Detroit who became a major figure in American public performance and whose essential message was an anti-Semitic one. The Jews are responsible for all of our economic woes.
Yes.
I've got something that I want to play for you, but before I play it, I want to put this question to you. If this were 1940, and you were yourself, but transposed and transported across time to that date, even though you are yourself, Amity Schles, of full maturity and knowing all that you know, who would you vote for in the election of 1940?
I would have voted for Wilkie. There was a young man named Aaron Root, who was Republican, New York, from a fancy family, Elihu Root, been in the cabinet. And he went to see Hoover in 1940 speak at the Young Republican Club, and he asked Hoover about the war. And Hoover said, I don't think Germany war is not a big likelihood. And the young man was very disgusted, and he marched out, and he said, I want someone different. And he turned to Wilkie, who was a businessman, the head of Commonwealth and Southern, the electricity conglomerate,
had been in combat with TVA. Yeah.
He had been at war with the TVA all through the 30s. And this part of Wilkie's past is often neglected. Wilkie was a free market person with a company. He was paid exactly the same as the president, around $75,000. And he didn't see any reason why his company shouldn't survive, but it was annihilated very slowly and painfully over the course of years and years by the TVA, and now he was becoming political. And Wilkie defined liberalism the old-fashioned way. The individual markets, leave me alone, have faith in economics, and he did it especially in the 30s. He gave a lot of speeches.
Now, one thing I wanted to work in, and we can then chat about it a bit after we hear it, is Wendell Wilkie giving a pitch on his liberalism and his ability to lead the country. It's during the campaign. This is a campaign speech. It runs about 2.5 minutes.
Because I am a businessman, of which, incidentally, I am very proud and was formerly connected with a large company, the doctrinaires of the opposition have attempted to picture me as an opponent of liberalism. But I was a liberal before many of those men heard the word, and I fought for the reforms of the elder La Follette and Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson before another Roosevelt adopted and distorted the word liberal. I believe that the forces of free enterprise must be regulated. I'm opposed to business monopolies. I believe in the right of collective bargaining by labor without any interference and full protection of that obvious right. I believe in minimum standards for wages and maximum standards for hours, and I believe that such standards should constantly improve. I'm in favor of the regulation of interstate utilities, of banking, of the security markets. I believe in federal pensions, in adequate old age benefits, and in unemployment allowances. I believe that the federal government owes a duty to adjust the position of the farmer with that of the manufacturer. If this cannot be done by parity prices, then some other method must be found without too much regimentation of the farmer's affairs. I believe in the encouragement of cooperative buying and selling, and in the full extension of rural electrification. And I believe that the federal government owes a very strong obligation to preserve our natural resources. But I do not base my claim to liberalism solely upon my support and advocacy of such reforms. American liberalism does not consist merely in reforming things. It consists primarily in making things. We must substitute for the philosophy of distributed scarcity the philosophy of unlimited productivity. I stand for the restoration of full production and re-employment in American private enterprise. The present administration has spent $60 billion The New Deal stands for doing what has to be done by spending as much money as possible. I propose to do it by spending as little as money as possible. This is one issue in this campaign that I intend to make crystal clear before the conclusion of the campaign so that everybody in this country may understand the tremendous waste of their resources and money that have taken place in the last 7.5 years.
There you have it. Our time is almost up. But having heard that, does that all the more strengthen your resolve to vote for Wendell Willkie in 1940?
Did I say vote for him? I'm not sure it would be right to vote for him, but I would have. I think that was actually Willkie at his best because he said, I'm not a crazy right-wing person who hates all government. I think it's fine. Many of the things that have happened in the New Deal are fine and necessary in our growing country, but let's place our faith where the faith belongs.